Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm your host, straight from New York, Ankit Panda. Joining me on the podcast today is, of course, my colleague, Associate Editor Franz-Stefan Gatti. And our special guest today is Colonel Retired James Creighton. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
And before we head into this conversation with Jim, which will be about Afghanistan's future in 2015, among other topics, I'd just like to briefly introduce Jim, who's had an amazing career in the U.S. Army, spanning over 30 years. He is currently the Chief Operating Officer of the East-West Institute here in New York City, and is very much an insider into the international, particularly ISAF and NATO war effort in Afghanistan. He was a commander of a combined team in Uruzgan province in Afghanistan for some years, in addition to being the Chief of Plans for ISAF Joint Command. And he also drafted the campaign plan for ISAF operations. So thanks again for joining us, Jim. We're very excited to have you here. Franz, I'll let you start this conversation. Why don't you hit Jim with his first question?
Thank you, Ankit. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Jim, for being on this podcast with us. My first question is more of a general question. I think a question that is very much interesting to the diplomat's audience and to a much larger group of people, and that is the current state of the Afghan National Security Forces. Now, going into 2015, do you think that with, on average, 100 Afghan soldiers and security forces dying per week, will the security forces be able to hold their ground against the Taliban in the next 12 months?
Yeah, I mean, short answer is yes. I know a lot of pundits will disagree with that, but I think at the end of the day, and as you define 2015 as the window of time, at the end of the day, they're fairly well equipped. They've got, in general, very good senior leadership. I know personally worked very closely with General Karimi and many of his senior staff at the Army level and down at the Corps level in the provinces. He's got some good senior leaders. The soldiers are good. They'll do like any soldier in any army. They'll do what they're trained to do and what their leaders make them do. Their biggest weakness from an army perspective is in their mid-level leadership. And that's one thing that I know that ISAF and the NATO Training Command have been working on. But that's they've been able to grow some leaders over the last 6 or 8 years, and I think that although there have been a lot of casualties, the bottom line is that they're standing and fighting. So I think for 2015 they'll be fine. In my mind, the question is how the police are going to do, and you know the Afghan army maintains a huge popularity advantage with the people over the police. But the police have also improved. In 2009, training and education of the police was put on as a priority. And as recently as yesterday, I talked to returning commanders who still have police as a priority in terms of education, training, professionalism, and making sure that as the security force most closely associated with the people, that they are well trained. So yeah, it's a tough fight. They are going to be into a continuous fight. They need NATO continued support and global support in order to maintain the financial backing required for such a large force. They may have to drop down in size because of that financial backing, but I think that they'll be good at least through 2015.
Thank you. Just to expand on that point, obviously under the terms of the recently concluded bilateral security agreement, the United States is keeping about 10,000 some forces in Afghanistan for, as you said, training and also limited counterterrorism operations. In your view, is the bilateral security agreement, the setup going on there, the 10,000 troops staying back in Afghanistan, going to have a significant positive, a net positive effect on the Afghan army's readiness for the security threats that are to come?
So there's a couple of ways to look at that, and the short answer to your question is it's absolutely necessary. I think that the limited duration of that is problematic. I mean, if you look at Japan, Korea, and Germany as the prime examples, we're still there. We're still there for a lot of different reasons. But at the end of the day, I think it was our presence in those three countries that allowed them to be all in the top 10 globally in terms of GDP and everything else. And so I think that the limited duration is the problem. I think that, you know, we'll see how 10,000 works out. From my personal experience, the more opportunity you gave the Afghans to excel, the more they stepped up to the plate and did so. Now, there were clearly failures where sometimes you just shook your head and you thought, well, shoot, I thought they were ready. And like I said earlier, from a leadership perspective, normally they weren't. But what we have found is that as we've given them responsibility and as they've taken responsibility, they've tended to do fairly well. But clearly, I think in order to sustain that over time, that training mission needs to continue and is vitally important to what we're doing.
Mm. It must be frustrating, I guess, from your perspective to, you know, witness the political and civil disinterest in the United States, particularly in terms of public opinion, with, you know, a prolonged involvement in Afghanistan beyond this year. Because, you know, with South Korea and Japan, you can make the case that both due to geopolitical relevance and also due to public opinion, the United States was able to have a very different post-war presence in those countries. But really, are you optimistic that the public debate in the United States will change in a way that will ultimately benefit Afghanistan in the long run? I'm personally skeptical, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I would hope that that would be the case, but I'm not holding my breath. I think that Afghanistan's much further away in the American psyche than either Korea or Japan or Germany, for that matter. So I think holding the U.S. populist interest in Afghanistan is a tall order. Not least of which is the money that it's going to cost to do that. But I look at it as we pick the war, we pick the fight, and we should see it through until a logical conclusion. There's an article by Max Boot today that, you know, described that, you know, the fact that we stuck to those countries and were successful, and it's hard to just declare victory regardless of the situation on the ground and go home. You know, I wouldn't say it's an overwhelming victory at this point, but I will say that there is a possibility that we could see stability over the coming years.
Mm-hmm. Can I jump in here just for a quick question? Jim, in your opinion, what really constitutes victory in Afghanistan? Is it the government controlling all the major population centers, or is it, you know, controlling every inch of the territory? What really constitutes victory in your opinion?
I mean, that's a tough question. Largely because we look at it from a grossly different lens than they look at it. And so when I see victory, I see it through Afghan eyes. I try to see it through Afghan eyes, which is a government that is acceptable to the Afghan people, and a government that can take care of its people economically, socially, politically, and militarily. And I think, you know, in some of those cases, we're moving in the right direction. I think that the arrangement right now between Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah is was a very deft political move on the part of Secretary Kerry and many others to come up with something that made sense to both of them. From my interaction with their staffs and people on there close to them, they both maintain optimism that they can work together and make it happen. I think that the delay in the cabinet is understandable given the tribal, political, ethnic, and cultural challenges that they're trying to do to balance the government. But I think it poses a significant risk right now in garnering support for their new government just because they need to establish the cabinet and move on, and they've been unable to do that to date.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about your experiences in Afghanistan. Specifically, I want to ask you a question based on an article that you wrote a few years earlier that caught my attention, which was about the role of bureaucracy. The way you put it in the piece was that bureaucracy is effectively and overregulation are both impediments to effective military and aid operations in Afghanistan. Obviously, you know, since you've written that article and in recent years, even this past week, we've seen reports coming out of the Special Inspector General's office, detailing the ways in which the United States military, government, USAID have been mismanaging funds, mismanaging resources, small arms have been getting lost in Afghanistan, all of these issues, which have, you know, made several observers say that we need more regulation, we need more oversight about how these things are being spent, how these things are being used in Afghanistan. As someone that, you know, was a commander in the field, could you just make the case on this podcast for why, you know, regulation maybe isn't the best in all situations, and why we should give, you know, military operations a little bit more of a free hand in operating?
Yeah, absolutely. In that article, my frustration was tempered quite a bit. And at the end of the day, our experience in Iraq, and if you look at the way the money flowed and the commander's emergency response funds, the money's hard to track. And in some cases, you look at it from a strictly an accountant's perspective, and you say, well, wait a minute. You know, if I was to go down and buy that at Home Depot, I'd pay $10 for it. How come it cost us $100, or how come it cost us $1,000? And the fact of the matter is, it's not Home Depot. It's just a very hard environment where you don't have electricity, you don't have roads, security is, you know, marginal, depending on where you're at, to poor, depending on where you're going. And so there's not a direct correlation between a dollar spent at Home Depot and a dollar spent in Erzgan, Afghanistan. So when they looked at it in Iraq, they said, well, we're wasting all this money because there's no oversight. Well, and then they developed these rules to say, okay, well, there's no oversight, so we won't create oversight. That's not a problem. And then what happens is you get, you know, the reason that the money was there in the first place was so that commanders had an ability to put people to work quickly, to resolve problems and help eliminate friction rather than getting soldiers killed. So if you have a farmer that's now a fighter and you make it worth his while to begin farming again instead of fighting, then you've taken someone that's going to shoot Americans on a battlefield, you've taken him off the battlefield without killing him. That's a good thing. And so part of this was brought on by expectation management, in that, you know, how are you going to account for all this stuff? And part of it was by a mismanagement or a misperception of the mission. You know, they tell you, well, the money that we're giving you is for this purpose, but you can't use it for that purpose because we've got so many regulations. The problem is you have a mismatch in a promise versus the ability to deliver. And that causes a significant amount of friction with the local populace, who have been led to believe that there are certain things that are possible, that they really aren't because of the overregulation. Now, that being said, challenges, you know, I'll give you an example of a school that you contract for that school to be built. USAID, Corps of Engineers, the World Bank, whoever it is. And it's a good idea. Is there a need for the school? Yes. Do you have kids ready to go to school? Absolutely. Do you have the money to spend to build a school? Yes. Okay, great. Let's do it. So then the organization, whether it's USAID or whether whoever it is, goes to Kabul and they say, oh yeah, we got a guy that can do that. And he contracts it. But then what he does is he subcontracts it down to Kandahar at a 10 or 20% fee. And then the Kandahar person subcontracts it to Erzgan or Dikundi or wherever at a 10 to 20% fee. And by the time you get into the middle of Dikundi, you've already spent 40% premium just because you failed to go to the local contractor. Of course, the local contractor doesn't have the capacity to do the project. And by the time the money gets to the local contractor, there's no ability for the World Bank or whomever to oversee the contract. So the money is given without the quality assurance that you would expect, even in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever it is that you go. And so the challenge with the money and the contracting and the bureaucracy is about managing expectations and about matching the mission with the capacity both of the U.S. forces to administer it and of the locals to execute it. An example is that, there was a great policy about Afghan first. Hire Afghans wherever you can. And I think everyone on the podcast will agree that's a great thing to do. Except where you contract them and do something that they don't have the physical capacity to do. For example, delivering several tons of fertilizer and seed for winter wheat. We want to grow winter wheat to keep the poppies from growing up. That's a great idea, great concept. Give it to the Afghans. Okay, that's great, except for the wheat comes in Herat, and they don't have the trucks or the aviation or the transportation assets to get it from Herat to Erzgan. And so rather than admit that they don't have that because you have an Afghan first policy, the seed goes to waste, and the fertilizer doesn't get delivered until 3 weeks after the winter growing season. So where you have fertilizer but no seed, and it's too late anyway. And then what you've done, instead of empowering the Afghans and building capacity, you've crushed them by emphasizing that they don't have the capacity, they can't do it anyway. And so it's not a simple question. It's very nuanced. And the soldiers, I believe in all instances, in most instances, have executed to the best of their ability with the honor integrity required of that amount of money. So, we created a situation where I had a lieutenant in Deir al-Wud who had to get certified. Now, he was certified in Germany for money operations before he came. Before he left Germany, they certified him. But when he came to Afghanistan, they said, oh, no, that certification that you got as directed by ISAF is no longer valid. So you have to go to Kandahar. Well, getting to Kandahar required a four-day trip between transportation and other things to get to Erzgan, another 3 days to get to Kandahar, and then the class is canceled, and he has to wait another week to the next class, and then it takes him another 2 weeks to get back. So even though he was certified in Germany, it took him 5 weeks to get the certification to get back to where his position was. And during those 5 weeks, that lieutenant wasn't doing his job. He was just trying to get certified in all the bureaucracy and regulations.
Thanks
a lot. The time of the story is that he starts then executing and they change the regulations before he can actually start working. So it's a frustrating environment.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot for that very detailed and insightful answer. I'll actually make sure to include a link to your piece on bureaucracy for our listeners so they can read your thoughts in greater detail about that issue. So just as we move towards the conclusion of this podcast, let's just take a step back from Afghanistan and just talk about U.S. military strategy more broadly. And obviously one of the questions that we want to ask you to avail of your expertise is counterinsurgency and its role in U.S. warfare and military strategy. So just very briefly, where do you see the role of counterinsurgency warfare as it was developed and refined in Afghanistan and Iraq in the future of the U.S. military?
It's a great question, and I guess if you really have to start with the United States' first dabble in counterinsurgency, which started in 1776, and was exceptionally successful. Of course, we were the insurgents. And so I think that the future of counterinsurgency is clearly a mission that the U.S. Army and the Marines and the military is going to have to deal with. We dealt with it in the Philippines at the turn of the last century. We obviously dealt with it in Vietnam, in Iraq, and Afghanistan. So it's not going away. It's something that we relearn and revise lessons all the time. And so I think that it's a very difficult mission. It's not as intense as high intensity conflict, but it's a long drawn out and hard fought mission. And I think it's something that we have to be able to do.
Jim, if I can just jump in here quickly with one question. So do U.S. Defense Strategic Guidance still include stability and coin operations on the list of 10 priority missions, right?
Yeah.
However, there now seems to be an aversion to the big coin stability and nation-building operations. So I'm not really questioning that coin will be part of the United States Army for the foreseeable future, but I'm really... maybe I'm narrowing down the question. I would like to get your thoughts on the big coin stability and nations building operations as we have seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do you think that will happen in the future again, or have we had enough?
Well, we never thought we'd get involved in it after Vietnam. So to say what's going to be in the future, I don't think it'll be in the next year or 2 years. And you clearly see an aversion in the political and cultural environment in the United States to getting involved in another Afghanistan. I mean, you see that in decisions that are made regarding Syria and other hotspots, and with Russia and the Crimea and Ukraine, the same thing. I mean, there's a big aversion. But I think at the end of the day, there will be politicians and American desire to get involved in this. Like I said, I don't see that in the next year or two, but you never know.
Absolutely. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us on this podcast and sharing your thoughts and your experiences in Afghanistan. We're obviously very, very grateful to have had you with us here today.
No, I appreciate it. The East-West Institute continues to look at the economic growth and stability in Afghanistan, and as our small part in capitalizing on the lives and treasure that we spend in Afghanistan, and doing our best to make Afghanistan a stable member of the nations and watch it grow and progress. It's a tough battle. There's a lot of work yet to be done. There's a lot of challenges and obstacles to be overcome. But I guess if you look at as you talk to the deputy ministers and the bureaucrats inside the ministries in Kabul and out of the districts, they're all educated. They're young. They're hungry. They want to make Afghanistan into a great place to live. It gives you a positive attitude when you talk to these young people. Same thing as you drive down the streets of Afghanistan, and if you talk to your grandfather in World War II, he would have said that the kids were asking for Hershey chocolate bars. But today, 100%, and I never saw a kid that did not ask for a pen and paper. All they want to do is be educated and to be a part of the modern world. And so as much as we can do to make that happen, I think it helps the United States and NATO and the coalition and the world realize the benefits from the treasure that they've expended in Afghanistan over the last 13 years.
Absolutely. That's very uplifting to hear about the interest in education in that country. Obviously, that's a very important issue. Franz, thanks also for joining me on this podcast. We will be back next week with more on The Diplomat. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Franz. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.